Thanks very much, James, for that that's a warm introduction, isn't it? And well, thank you for all coming. So the theme of my talk today is the happiest life. So I only after I submitted this blurb did I realise, happiest is a nice choice, sort of unconsciously on my part. I'm not claiming that life is happy, but that there might be a most happy way of going about our lives, or at least we can think in those terms of what would be the happiest life. So there's my gambit. This is quite a recent theme for me, so I'll be sharing mainly ideas, since I take that's kind of my interest, as it were, the ideas of Buddhism and how they can how we can explore them and live them out. So I'll be talking about ideas for you to perhaps chew on in an end of festival travelling home kind of way, which might be of use in your reflections on life and what to do. And I'm going to be drawing on, of course, Buddhism, early Buddhism, but also the early Greek philosopher Epicurus. You might have heard of Epicurus. Sounds like Epicurean, doesn't it? Sounds like he might be a connoisseur of fine things. Actually, that's not exactly what his philosophy is about. He prized the happiness that comes from simple living and got misrepresented by the Roman Stoics. So anyway, we won't go into that too much. So I want to draw on the thought of Epicurus together with Buddhism to give us some ideas about the happiest life. There we go. I'm drawn to this topic, I realise, because when I was younger, perhaps, you know, late teens, early 20s, I think for me, as I was exploring life, who I was, perhaps spirituality in a beginning stage, beginning kind of way, the feeling of happiness, the feeling of that rich internal sense of well-being was like a guiding star, I think, for my choices, for what I valued. I'm not sure everyone has this experience. Would anybody else resonate with that? Any hands up? Anybody not? Would that be something that wouldn't be familiar? Okay, so it's a sort of semi-familiar thing. I'll go from there. And I think for me that relates to the fact that I had a very happy childhood. A very happy childhood, which is something you only really become to appreciate as you get older, as you kind of run into unhappiness, I think, in yourself and in others. So I was brought up in a small village in Somerset and had the advantages of natural beauty in the fields, in the woods around, a quite large extended family living nearby, and that's quite a lot to be said for it, I think. Access to lots of different relatives and neighbours and all this, and a close community, and of course a loving family. But presumably there's something else involved to do with what I brought to the situation, and from an early age I noticed that there was a contrast between my experience and that of my dad. As I got older, I noticed that he'd say things like, "The point of life is not to be happy; it's to do your duty." Yeah, is this a familiar? Anybody heard this any time? No way. Yeah. The point of life is not to be happy, and this really mystified me. This was quite a it's not something I could easily make sense of. So I had to work it out over the years through conversations with my dad. He's a wonderfully open man, my dad. And it turns out that he had a very strong vocation to be a Catholic priest as a young man, but it didn't work out It didn't work out. And so instead he had a family, which then put me in a slightly awkward position talking to him about about happiness. As you might know, Catholic priests are supposed to be celibate. So, you know, had he done what he really wanted to do, I may not have existed quite in this form. It's a really strange question, isn't it? Would we exist had our parents not conceived us? For him, family life was like a second choice. Does that make sense? And I don't think he particularly liked family life. Poor old dad. He didn't even warm to it, I don't think. He just did his best. Does that make sense? He did his best. And so as I look back now, even as I say this, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it, that for him the point of life wasn't to be happy but to do your duty. And if that's to be a good parent, to do those things which go along with being a good parent, that's what the point of life is. And there's a connection there with the philosophy of Stoicism, which actually fed into Christian ideas. My dad was a very devout Catholic. In the Stoic way of looking at things, in the Stoic universe, as it were, everything is already decided by fate, or God, perhaps, if one uses that language. Everything's already decided. So your desires, should they be not really in line with what's been decided for you, are just going to get frustrated, are they not? So it's the route to the best life is to put aside your own desires and fully assent to how life unfolds. It's a kind of fatalism. It's a fatalism. This, how it unfolds, is the best it could possibly be. That's the nature of providence. The universe is unfolding just as it should. Your job is to tune into that, become familiar with it, put aside your deluded own desires, and do your duty. I'm deeply opposed to this point of view. I really would like it if there was a Stoic in the audience who would say, "You've got it wrong. Stoicism is not like that." Ah. Stoicism's having a bit of a renaissance at the moment, at least in bookshops. Who knows? I may be misrepresenting it, but contrast has really thrown me back on how I'm not a Stoic. By contrast, I'm much more drawn to Epicurean philosophy, which we'll get onto. Having said that, there's clearly a problem with basing your life on happiness. Yeah? For me, I got to a certain point when I fell in love again with the wrong person, as you were. Actually, she was beautiful, she was lovely. She was also a she-devil from hell. And I really came out a loser from that. I think it shook me up because I thought I'd made the right decision. Yes, following my heart and my happiness. But it was I'd been totally naive. Looking back, of course, I mean, there were all sorts of reasons why that particular person acted in the way she did. And I'm very aware of that now. And it was my naivety that was the problem. So the simple quest for happiness can be accompanied by, when it's not accompanied by wisdom, just takes us into situations that lead us to be unhappy. In any case, happiness, it comes and goes. Is that a familiar kind of experience? Sometimes there's no reason, apparent reason, is there? One can wake up happy. Life is a beautiful place. The world is beautiful. And you think this is how it should be. And on some other occasion, it just doesn't seem like that. Perhaps even on this festival, which is a happy place, I'd say, on the whole, there might have been moments when you weren't happy. Would anybody care to admit that? Has there been an unhappy moment? Oh! Yeah. In my study group, we had a little check-in yesterday. We were discussing solitude, and we just each shared a solitary moment from this very communal festival. And it was very striking how important it was, these solitary moments. But then it turned out there were also lonely moments. In the midst of this, you know, quite extraordinary community, there's loneliness. And it's not so visible, is it? You don't get a big lot of big wave of sort of obvious loneliness coming out of the field. It's much more private. So the whole idea of basing your life on happiness, I think with a certain maturity and growing up, you think, well, that can't be the whole picture. That can't be the whole picture. So quite rightly, I think, at a certain point in our growing up, we look more broadly than simply taking happiness as our guiding star. Or maybe people don't. Maybe they just keep going and you know, go through different experiences. I'm not sure. I suppose I should say, for me personally, I took a different route. I discovered Buddhism, or took to Buddhism more seriously, in my mid-20s. And I think the aspect of Buddhism that particularly drew me in my mid-20s was the promise, the call to insight, to clear seeing into how things are, and the promise that with clear seeing and wisdom there'd be enough understanding to avoid, well, to know how to live in a way that was not problematic for myself and contributed to the well-being of the world. I hope that doesn't sound too ambitious. It's just what attracted me at that time. I'm not saying I managed it. It's just what attracted me. But even then, early Buddhism very much stresses that there is suffering, and that Buddhism promises the end of suffering. But even at that stage, I couldn't really relate to the idea that there is suffering very strongly. I was still a bit, quite happy quite a lot of the time, to put it that way. And yet this promise of insight promised something further, yeah, beyond my own ideas about happiness. So I've recently been reassessing this whole approach to Buddhism in terms of insight, let's say. And I think there's two reasons for that. Firstly, my dad died 3 years ago, and he died from a kidney cancer that became a brain tumour, and meant that he declined in a particular way. He came home in the end. I helped my mum nurse him with my brother and sister at home, and then over 3 months he declined and died. And I think that was, for me, a real encounter with how life is quite a mix of experiences. And for many people, it's characterised by suffering. Yeah, there's a kind of suffering nature to life because of our organic... We're born, we get ill, we get old, and we die. And we can't avoid those things. If there's felt sense of happiness in the meantime, that's a very good thing, but we can't avoid a certain encounter with suffering. And that's thrown me back onto a reassessment of my understanding, as it were, of the possibilities of happiness. And that reassessment's been accompanied by experiences in meditation, which have led me to sort of understand think about happiness in perhaps a deeper, more robust, more universal way. So that's what I want to get on to. So now on to some ideas, perhaps. If I was to use the word hedonism, if I was to talk about hedonism, you'd probably think that I was talking about the doctrine or belief that pleasure is what counts. Is that right? Is that what's important is pleasure. And we usually describe people as hedonists, who are really committed to their sense pleasures. Yeah. So she's a real hedonist. she likes to enjoy herself, looks for pleasure in life. So I actually want to defend the idea of hedonism, that hedonism is a good thing, but in a completely revised form. So I'm going to put forward the idea of a revisionary hedonism. So it's revised because how we think about what is pleasurable and what happiness is, I'm going to try and get us to think about in a different way. But the important thing is that what's really important is pleasure and happiness. So this is the bit where hopefully this will give you something to chew on, because you may, I suppose even for myself, it seems like a slightly, not dangerous belief exactly, but one that might be a bit problematic if you think that what's really important is pleasure and happiness. It's like you might get into trouble. Or is that just me? Maybe it's my dad's voice. So what's really important is pleasure and happiness in a revised way. So just to stick with our ordinary conception of hedonism, there's a philosopher called Jeremy Bentham, the founder of utilitarianism in the 18th century, and he made the point that nature has provided us with two sovereign masters in the form of pleasure and pain. These sovereign masters, in as much as our experience of pleasure and pain give us the most direct and indisputable indications of what is right and wrong, good and bad in life. You can't argue with pleasure and pain. If you were to suffer some pain, you wouldn't say, oh, this is good. You'd know that this was bad. So this became the basis of the utilitarian philosophy, which is that what's good is that action or policy which maximises happiness. And it sounds like a terrible kind of philosophy, really, doesn't it? Or at least one that it's got a kind of bad name. But I think, in a way, we should appreciate things like how utilitarianism, well, Jeremy Bentham anyway, he emphasised how animals experience pleasure and pain, much like humans. Therefore, to cause animals pain is to, as it were, not maximise happiness. So it's quite wrong, yeah? If you really believe in utilitarianism and the right thing to do is to maximise happiness, to knowingly allow animals to suffer is simply wrong. And that's had a huge effect. It's as if it didn't occur to people up to that point, if you see what I mean. If you think of an animal as someone whose existence is to serve a human, say a horse or a cow or so on, and they're clearly not humans, then you've got no sort of basis for really thinking about animal welfare. So in a way, animal rights begins with utilitarianism. So we shouldn't think too badly of utilitarianism. That's what I'm getting at. Nevertheless, when it comes to human beings, if we just suppose that maximising our pleasure and happiness is going to lead to the best kind of life, it sounds like rather a generalisation, doesn't it? It might work at a certain level for social policy, but it might not. You might think, oh, I'm not sure if this is going to answer all my existential needs. I suppose I'm thinking that recently there's been a bit of a move to think about happiness in social policy. That's more important than maximising GDP, yeah? And one result of these happiness surveys that you might have heard about is that beyond a certain level of income, beyond a certain sort of subsistence level of income, I suppose it would be about £20,000 for us in the UK right now, people don't get any happier with more money in terms of what they report as happiness. They just report the same levels of happiness. But people really want more money. So their desires are going into creating more money, working harder. But often that's not actually associated with an increase in happiness and well-being. So one could really ask, well, if that was what was hoping for, that isn't a great strategy. There's been some surprises from that research as well, that it turns out that one of the greatest keys for happiness is being in a relationship. Is that a surprise? I don't know. Maybe it's obvious. But, you know, some of us, well, not myself, but you might think, well, gosh, that suddenly puts a big pressure on getting into a relationship. And surely there's other... The Buddha wasn't in a relationship. So was he a miserable old fellow? Do you see what I mean? So these kind of generalisations don't necessarily help us with understanding happiness. And anyway, there's two big problems with this kind of view of hedonism. Firstly, aiming our lives at happiness is just a disaster. Yeah. If you were to now think, what will make me happy? Yeah, and then go and try and do that. It's going to be really tough, isn't it, to work out that thing which will definitely work. It'll be a bit of a mind-bending kind of exercise. Should I do the shamanic dance workshop? Will that be the thing? Or should it be spoon carving? Not.
Mine broke.
That's it. Perhaps our friend thought that happiness was in a wooden spoon. And his broke. It's a disaster of hedonism. If there is happiness, it can only be a byproduct, can't it, of our doing other things which give life meaning. If you aim for happiness, it's going to break. So the only happiness that is really going to satisfy is that which is a byproduct, as it were, of living in a way that is. In some other way, meaningful, let's say. It seems more reliable, doesn't it? And of course, that means not aiming at it at all. Then how do you be a hedonist? Another problem, another disastrous thing about hedonism is, how about this? Happiness is just biological. You've got a certain kind of brain chemistry, yeah? You've got a certain kind of neural workings, in which certain kinds of hormones get released under certain kinds of conditions. Serotonin, dopamine, any others? Oxytocin? Yeah, I think that's the three, isn't it? Thank you. My medic plant is nodding. So if these kinds of brain chemicals are released, you're going to enjoy happiness. If they're not, you're going to feel miserable. That's how it is. You can alter these with drugs, of course, but then you're in a very different sort of area, aren't we? So usually for most of us, our actual experience of happiness is in a certain sort of band determined by our neurochemistry. So however that is what we have to live with. Oh, blimey, that sounds materialistic, doesn't it? I'm just trying to put problems with hedonism, aiming at happiness. Runs up against that sort of biological difficulty. So you're probably thinking, now where the hell is he going to go from there? He's just run hedonism into a disaster zone. So I'm going to turn now to Epicurus and the Dharma, these two sources of wisdom about happiness, to get around these disasters with hedonism in a revisionary kind of way. So, firstly, Epicurus made this point about desires, there's three sorts of desires. And if we can understand this, we're going to be able to live in a more happy way. So, firstly, they're desires which are natural and necessary. Yeah. So, natural and necessary. Can you think of a natural, necessary desire?
Hunger.
Water,
sleep,
shelter,
safety.
you can't, if your desires for food, drink, shelter, sleep, if you don't act on them, you really won't be well, will you? You'll suffer in a very clear way. They're necessary for our survival. So those desires are ones where we have to attend to. Then there's desires which are natural and unnecessary. Natural and unnecessary, which is to say they're perfectly natural, but they're unnecessary to our well-being. Any ideas?
Poetry.
Wow.
Friendship.
Friendship.
Showers.
Yeah. It's good, isn't it, with the cues? But, yeah. And maybe sex, I don't know, depends, doesn't it? And also, you know, more subtly speaking, you know, you could be thirsty, you could be thinking, well, shall I go and get a chai or a mango smoothie? Yeah, chai, mango smoothie. Actually, it doesn't matter which, does it? You're thirsty, you need to drink, but which delicious, wholesome beverage you drink is not very crucial. Both will do. So it's unnecessary to drink a mango smoothie. Nevertheless, you need to drink. Finally, the third sort of desire are those that are groundless, due to groundless opinion. So here's a quote from Epicurus. Of our desires, some are natural and necessary, others are natural but not necessary, and others are neither natural nor necessary but are due to groundless opinion. Groundless opinion. So, the examples that are usually given are things like desire for fame or success. Anybody here with a desire for fame or success? Yeah. I mean, it's groundless because there's no natural basis to this. You'll be perfectly all right. You'll be fine if you don't get some fame and success. Yeah? But there's quite a risk having. There's no way to actually make that happen. Yeah, to make it make it happen that you get fame and success. It could be that you've seen on the notice board that there's this great workshop. Should we stick with shamanic dancing? You know, your friend said, "Oh, you put on a blindfold, you go in there, and you do this thing, and it's great." And you get there and it's full. The workshop's full and you can't go in. So you've just had somebody's ideas about what's so great about this workshop. So your desire is kind of based on an opinion, but it's groundless. You won't die if you haven't been to that workshop. So if you can hold on to that distinction of three kinds of desires, natural and necessary, natural and unnecessary, and based on groundless opinion, or neither natural or necessary, you can, in any situation, go through in your mind, what kind of desire is this that I'm experiencing? Is it one that, if I don't satisfy, I will suffer, or is it groundless in this kind of sense of I'll be just fine? And this is quite a powerful exercise to just simplify down our experience to what's really necessary. Because we're not judging desires, are we? We're just noticing there's different sorts. And to my mind, this gives a really useful way of understanding this very curious early Buddhist teaching that the cause of our suffering is desire. We might have come across this. The cause of our suffering is tanha, craving or desire. And that sounds like the answer must be this deep renunciation of what we desire. But that sounds a bit miserable as well, doesn't it? A deep renunciation of everything we desire. Love, food, poetry. So one way I think that's very useful for understanding this is that what's being recommended is putting into context that there are different kinds of desires, and the complete ending of groundless desires would just leave you what?
Empty.
Of groundless desires. Yeah, sorry. Anybody? Content, that's what I'm getting at. One would still be, you know, very aware of one's natural, necessary desires and aware of what's unnecessary in some of our desires, so we're not making a big fuss about the mango smoothie if they've run out of mango. Maybe chai is just fine. So here's a kind of way of thinking about simplifying things down. And Epicurus himself lived out this simple life in a kind of ashram or community called the Garden near Athens. So in the heyday of Greek philosophy, Epicurus and his followers lived in the Garden, a community of men and women who withdrew, as it were, from the hurly-burly of public life to live together, talking philosophically in this kind of way about what is the best kind of life and how to live it. It does sound a bit reminiscent, doesn't it, of a certain sort of community ideal, which is kind of still going, at least among Buddhists, which got me onto thinking about Epicurus and Buddhism. For Epicurus, this kind of thinking about the nature of pleasure and desire was really the exercise. This is what philosophy was about. What other purpose for philosophy, he said, is there than to be a therapy for the soul? So he compared philosophy to a kind of medicine for the soul. What would be the point of doing philosophy in some sort of completely abstract way if it didn't actually solve our difficulties? If it didn't heal us in some way? And this is very reminiscent of how the Buddha described himself as the great surgeon who removes the dart of suffering. So the Dharma is not something to take literally, to suppose, oh, this is the truth. If we believe in the Dharma, we'll be well again. The point is to use it for the healing of existential suffering. And you might remember the simile of the raft. The simile of the raft. Oh monks, the Dharma is like a raft. It's to be used for getting across the ocean of conditioned existence, the ocean of samsara. So it's a useful thing. You need a raft, unless you're an extremely good swimmer. But it's very choppy and the water's full of alligators, you know, according to this kind of simile. But once you get to the other side of the ocean of conditioned existence, which is nirvana, what do you do with the raft? Do you put it on your head and keep on carrying it? No. You put it down, yeah? So then you're free. You don't need the raft anymore. So likewise, monks, the Dharma is for crossing over, not for holding on to. That's what the Buddha said. And I think there's a very deep parallel there with the idea of philosophy as a therapeutic exercise, something to be studied for the sake of existential healing. So let's go deeper into some ideas from Epicurus that help with existential healing. These are the ones I'm particularly interested in. Epicurus thought about the nature of pleasures, our very pleasures, these basic irreducible ways of our body or organism responds to experience that are no doubt sort of deeply embedded in our biochemistry, but nevertheless have a sort of clear experiential dimension. Epicurus distinguished between two sorts of pleasures here. There are the dynamic pleasures, kinetic is the Greek, anybody knows Greek. Dynamic or kinetic pleasures are those pleasures which arise in relation to the satisfying of those changes in our body and experience, those changes which demand us to do something. So, you know, when you get thirsty, there's a sort of nagging lack, isn't there? A sort of sense of inner dryness, which is the message, you know, slightly painful message. Ah, need to go and get the chai or water if you're really thirsty. And same with hunger, isn't there? There's a sort of sense of lack or slight nagging pain which sends us off looking for food. So these kinds of pleasures. I think they expand further than that. We have mental pleasures, pleasures of the mind and heart as well, which arise in relation, which relies in relation to our mood, let's say, or our thoughts about what is going on in our lives. I really wish I was doing ecstatic dance with Jules, you know. What's that?
I
think
it's women only.
Oh, I've got a groundless desire here to go and do women only ecstatic dance. Yeah, yeah. But surely, under the law these days, all I need to do is say I'm a woman, and I can go. Hooray for the law! No, that was just light-hearted. It's great to have a women's ecstatic dance, of course. Backtracking there from my humour, sorry. But there's another sort of pleasure, and this is what Epicurus gets on. He calls them katestematic. Apparently, this is hard to translate from Greek. If we think about them as constitutional pleasures, that gives us some way into this kind of idea that there's a pleasure simply in the well-being and freedom from suffering and illness in our body and experience. So I wonder if, you know, it's a bit noisy and everything now, but have you experienced it on this? In this festival at any time. That's beautiful. That's dynamic pleasure, by the way. That's kinetic pleasure. Yeah. Afterwards, they'll all be, their endorphins will be gone and they'll collapse into a. Anyway, have you had any moments when you've just settled into a sense of simply enjoying the moment in a very simple way? Is that familiar? When you've. A kind of pleasure which doesn't require you to go outside of what's actually happening. Yeah? We could call it contentment, couldn't we? But in a way, it's a kind of pleasure as well. I think that's Epicurus's point. It's a kind of actual pleasure which sometimes we notice and is quite distinct. And at those moments, we really, if somebody said, hey, do you want to come and do some really fantastic ecstatic dance? You might think, I don't need to. Does that make sense? My experience is perfectly enjoyable as it is. And Epicurus makes the point that, this is where the philosophy comes in. If you know about this distinction, at any moment, you can look for constitutional pleasure in your experience. You can, if you can find it, you don't need to worry about those other sort of desires based on possible pleasures that you might have should you get a really good smoothie or excellent see that band that your friend has said is playing up at Small World, you know, at 3 p.m. and so on. So constitutional pleasures are these simple pleasures that belong to the very basis of our bodily experience. Not all the time obviously, but very often. That's the point. And even when we're not having them, we can perhaps remember them. And when we remember these constitutional pleasures, then we can relax into contentment. So this is a way, reflecting in this way, this kind of way, is a way in which philosophy can be therapeutic of our restlessness, which keeps taking us away from the possibilities of settling into what's actually happening. So you can see probably where I might be heading towards the Dharma here. There's quite a lot of early Buddhist discourses which explain a certain unfolding of the spiritual path. In fact, there's one lovely one which starts with a comparison. Suppose there was a tree with branches and leaves flourishing. Its bark will come to full development, and its inner bark, sapwood and heartwood, will come to full development. So the Buddha compares the human being with a tree coming into full development, flourishing. Yeah. So how's that gonna? How are we like a tree which is coming into full flourishing and development? In the same way, monks, the Buddha says, for one who practices ethics, who's virtuous, who attends to keeping the precepts, acting in a way which doesn't harm ourselves and others, yeah, there's the arising of freedom from remorse, the sense of living with a good conscience. We can't really get around that. If we would like to enjoy happiness and well-being, we can't get around the need to establish ourselves in a certain sort of integrity, knowing how to act in relation to ourselves and others, which doesn't cause problems. Yeah, and in fact, it positively is devoted to love, generosity, contentment, and truth. This is kind of familiar, I imagine, but so I'm not going to dwell on it. There's no way around this, I don't think, for anybody. The idea that happiness can come without a grounding in ethics. But with this kind of freedom from remorse as a condition arises gladness. The feeling that one is living as one is experiencing this freedom from remorse. The sense that one's living a good life, even if one isn't, things aren't going well, you know, you're doing your bit, as it were, not to spread more suffering. But then this spiral path turns to experiences which are perhaps more based on meditation. For someone who experiences gladness, there arises joy, piti, priti, often translated rapture. So in the Buddhist spiritual life, there's a really important stage when one starts to meditate, and using an object of meditation such as the breath or metta, loving kindness, speaker metta, then the mind and heart begins to settle. The distractions of your mind, just through this constantly coming back to the object of meditation, there's a settling in your experience. And there can be this release of energy in your body, a rapture and joy that just comes from letting go of the tensions that you didn't even know you were holding as you were engaged in rushing around in whatever way, or engaged in being anxious about what's next, what you need to do, your duties and obligations. So in the course of meditation, there's a very important stage where there's a kind of really quite rapturous relaxation and letting go of tensions. Has anybody experienced that in meditation? Is that familiar? Yeah. A few of you, yeah. And it's quite subtle, would you agree? And the important thing here is that quite often when there's a sense of this experience arising to start with, we kind of grab onto it because it's so fantastic. And that immediately has the effect of it just backs off. Like someone who doesn't want to be hugged, as it were. It can't be hugged, this kind of experience. You can't hold on to it. You can't grasp it. But after a while, then you come near it again. And again, a certain rapture arises, joy, and you relax. And it arises. And it turns out it's not really yours. It's not yours at all. It's just the body's way of unwinding and relaxing. Of releasing the tensions that have built up. So this is very therapeutic. And then with this as condition, this isn't an automatic process. This is an unfolding of stages that actually accompanies making quite an effort at discipline, meditation and so on. Arises happiness. This is the teaching. So this happiness or sukha is more of a heartfelt sense of well-being. This heartfelt sense of well-being can arise through meditation, according to this Buddhist model of the spiritual life. And again, this is something one can, as it were, one can look for. One can ask, is there happiness in my experience? Is it over there hiding in the bushes? If I look carefully, will it come out? But nevertheless, it's not under your control. Does that make sense? There's a sort of interplay between your knowing about happiness and it coming forward and being something that you that is there in your heart. So I think this joy and happiness that is described in the Buddhist spiral path is very similar to the constitutional pleasures that Epicurus described as being a kind of constant experience of contentment that you can always find your way to explore and relax into. So there's a kind of parallel here in the therapeutic path towards well-being between Epicurus and the Dharma, which makes me think about how perhaps this process of finding a non-kinetic, a kind of non-exciting sort of pleasure and happiness might be a process that's found in other sort of disciplines. Actually, going back to ecstatic dance and what the women are doing there, I do a lot of five rhythms and similar sort of dance forms. And although it's not, I wouldn't really compare it to meditation, I think there's a very similar sort of dynamic involved. You start with your body just as it is, and by a process of letting go of all those groundless kind of desires to look good, you know, and worries, pretty groundless worries about what's going on and these crazy people, what are they doing, and so on, one finds one's way into the fact that the body really enjoys moving. Yeah, from time to time there's definitely a place for the body just moving and dancing out its experience of life, and usually that can very often lead to quite a lot of inner joy. Has anybody had inner joy through dance? Oh, lots, yeah, yeah. And you can probably recognise this. It's not something you can force, is it? If you try, it doesn't work usually. But there's certain conditions, like if you relax, you go through your body. Often if you find somebody, if you connect with somebody, there can be often, that can really help you just relax and so on. So I suspect this kind of process is not limited to Epicurean therapy or Buddhist meditation, but it's one that's common to other kinds of disciplines. This process of finding inner joy, pleasure and happiness that arises through bringing about the conditions. So what happens from this kind of finding this inner pleasure and joy? I'd say that it softens us up. It softens up the heart. It makes the heart pliable and workable. This is the Buddhist position, point of view. And with a pliable and workable heart, it's possible to really reflect on our experience. And this is one way towards insight in the Buddhist understanding. But nevertheless, insight itself is not something that's unhappy or beyond happiness and joy. The very experience of a pliable, workable heart that clearly sees things is one which is actually suffused by joy and happiness. There's some verses from the Dhammapada in which repeat over and over again that Nirvana is ultimate bliss. Nirvana is ultimate bliss. Nibbanam paramam sukham. So it's not simply the absence of desires, the squishing of everything that is going to take us from insight, but there's some sort of inner happiness. I suspect it's very difficult to describe it from an unawakened perspective, but I'm just sharing that idea that maybe awakening itself is ultimate bliss. Now, the Stoics among you who I know are keeping quiet will say, well, hang on, this is just simply massively egotistical. What you're talking about is some individual experience of well-being without any relationship to the world. And the Epicurean in me will have to say, no, you haven't really thought it through yet. You haven't thought it through. when one starts to experience this constitutional kind of pleasure, the pleasures of joy and happiness through meditation, this workability of the mind and heart, it becomes more and more clear that how we experience, how we as individuals experience joy and happiness is just like everybody else. Yeah. Paul and Rob and our friends here, all of you experience happiness just like me. We share the same sort of organic nature. And as we actually stop being so caught up in anxiety and these desires which have no real basis in any chance of being satisfied except through luck, really, as we find some contentment, we notice, well, this is every single human being has this kind of organism, and actually, especially amongst our friends, it's possible to value their happiness just as much as our own. If you have this experience, your friend's in trouble, you just respond, yeah, with a sense of, well, they're unhappy, it's my happiness, their happiness. It's not actually much different, is it? There's a sort of continuity because of our shared human inheritance. But all we can work on is our own minds and hearts. We can reach out to others, we can help them. But it strikes me that this is the basis of compassion, in fact. Rather than compassion being our duty, an obligation that comes from seeing that we're all one human family, and divine providence is our overarching guide, I think the quest for happiness can also be a way in which we can find a route in life to really consider how our lives can be of benefit to others. Because after all, once we get to a certain kind of experience of happiness, our lives will be suffused with meaning in a certain way. We will have learned something so important that there'll be a desire to share that in whatever way is our own gift and vision, as it were. And that spreading of happiness will be exactly the kind of work of compassion that I believe that the Buddhist tradition is promoting. There's a connection there with imagination, I think. The way human beings, we don't experience alone, as it were, through poetry, through imagination. Our experience of pleasure and happiness actually extends beyond ourselves, well beyond ourselves, to the whole world, in fact. Because time's going on, that's enough. So, to sum up, what I've wanted to say is that the happiest life is one of simple natural desires. Simple natural desires, we can look after them, we can look into them. Of deeply suffused inner joy, we can look after that. We can reason towards, we can practice awareness towards working out how to bring the conditions into being for deeply suffused inner joy. And the happiest life includes a circle of friends with whom to practice love, to imagine the wider implications of happiness. So the Stoics among you will go away and discuss the pros and cons of that. It's my bid, that's my bid for the Epicurean form of Buddhism, for the possibility, the real possibility of the happiest life. So thank you very much.